From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a question. Is it bad to be brown? That question was asked by a 6-year-old boy named Z, who is biracial. His father is white and Jewish, his mother is Indian. Z is dark-skinned like his mother, and he asked his mother that question in 2014 after the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson. And there were more questions. He asked, quote, "Are white people afraid of brown people?" His mother, writer Mira Jacob, deflected and reassured. And then Z asked a third question. Is daddy afraid of us? The New York Times shared this story in a review of Mira's new book, Good Talk. It's a graphic novel of conversations she's had with Z and other family members about race, color, sexuality, and love. To give Z answers, Mira has to think back to similar questions she asked as a child and what was shared with her. The book addresses political and social issues that are at the forefront of conversations across America and around the world, and it's one example of how literature can react to and even shape those issues. Mira Jacob will be in Rochester in June for Writers and Books' Ladder Literary Conference, where she'll speak about the art of the memoir and how to transform difficult truths into published work. Mira's going to join us later this hour for a conversation about the role of literature, and we'll also address Rochester's role as a literary hub. Our city is home to a number of remarkable writers, like our guest in studio today, and Rochester also a hotspot for nationally acclaimed writers. One of them, the new executive director of Writers and Books, Allison Myers, who took on that role earlier this month and in studio for the first time today. It's great to have you. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
It's a big, big part in our community, and there was a lot of debate about who would fill the spot. So you get to meet Allison this hour, and also welcome to the other guests in studio. Alex Sanchez is a local writer and panelist at the Ladder Literary Conference coming up. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And also with us is Katyra Poland, who is a local writer and a panelist coming up here. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start just a little bit of the background of the new executive director. So welcome to Rochester. How long have you been here now?
7 days. Yeah. not counting the day that I, a very long day I spent at Writers and Books with staff and board and stakeholders of Writers and Books sometime in April.
We hope that everyone from Writers and Books gets used to coming in and grabbing the microphone and having conversations, because we love talking about literature. We love talking about the impact of literature on social and political parts of our lives, and so we're going to have a lot of great talks. But tell us a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in rural Maine. My dad was a school teacher at a preparatory high school there, and then moved to Connecticut when I was about 15, and in my adulthood was somewhat peripatetic, but mostly living in the Northeast with a stint in Oberlin, Ohio, when I managed Oberlin College's bookstore.
And what in the world convinced you to come to Rochester now? I mean, we're thrilled you are. But tell us kind of how that path brought you here.
Through the nonprofit Literary Arts Network, and I've known about Writers and Books for a long time.
It's got a reputation, doesn't it?
Has a reputation, and our Literary Arts New York State community is fairly collegial and tight-knit and mutually supportive. So, you know, I've been acquainted with Joe for some time, primarily through an umbrella organization called Lit Tap.
Talking about Joe Flaherty, one of the previous directors. Yep.
Yes, the founding director. Mm-hmm. And for 10 years, I directed Cave Canem Foundation in New York City. Cave Canem is the premier organization for Black poetry and poetics in the country. And so I really, after an intermediate time doing some other work in the nonprofit world, including consulting, I decided I really wanted to put my roots down and identify with one organization again. And I think Rochester provides wonderful opportunities and challenges as well, and is a community where I feel that I can engage with literature in meaningful ways, as you've mentioned, culturally and socially, politically, and there's that kind of legacy with Writers and Books as well. So I think it's a wonderful match temperamentally and in terms of my personal goals.
I always try to avoid sort of cliche questions like this, like name one book that shaped your life. But I do kind of want to ask you if now at this part of your life, especially with Writers and Books, if you get a chance to read much for pleasure, or is almost everything that you're reading kind of like me, It's got to be for work because we're always reading for work. Is that kind of the case with you?
No, I only read for pleasure.
Oh, see, this is a very exciting to hear this. Okay. And so how do you decide how to navigate the world in choosing what you? Nobody can read everything they'd like to read. How do you make your decisions?
Because primarily I read poetry. I'm a poet and nonfiction. And reading Good Talk by Mira was a choice. Of course, I did know we were going to talk about it today and she'll be at the latter, but it's exactly the kind of text that engages me. I love this book. I think it's transformational. And I think it's a book for all teenagers in the country, for instance, to read, as well as most white people.
All right. So I'm going to ask Allison, because it's first time, do me a favor, grab that microphone, just physically thrust it towards yourself. There you go. Bring it even more over to, there you go. See?
Okay.
Because that way we're nice and intimate now.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be able to hear you nice and clearly. So we're going to talk to Mira Jacob later this hour here. But you mentioned the ladder coming up here.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what the goal of the ladder is.
It's as it promotes itself, write, edit, connect, and publish. Those are the steps on the ladder. And the idea is to engage writers at whatever professional stage they're at with contextualizing their work in terms of their ambition to publish. And so in many ways, it's informational, but it's also, I think, kind of emotionally, spiritually, and intellectually supportive all around the life of the writer. We live in a culture where actually getting published is probably more challenging than ever because of the centralization of the publishing industry. But there are so many success stories, and particularly now in the burgeoning of small presses, which are proliferating and thriving despite the challenges. There are many avenues for writers to have their voices heard and to just interact on a peer basis and find new mentors. This is the place, I think, for regional writers to come and take advantage of this.
All right. And you can take advantage by getting online at Writers and Books right now. The the ladder is coming up. What are the details, Allison? What do you want people to know?
Well, I guess I'll put my glasses on.
I always wear my glasses in studio for that reason.
I'm actually not seeing the date on this crib sheet that I brought. I do see the
time. I'm going to get it for you. Don't you worry. But people can still register. People can still
June
get involved.
Yes. June 8th.
Are you looking for Chris Fanning?
No.
Is that who you're looking for? The ubiquitous Chris Fanning? You're going to find out that he is more trouble than he's worth. We actually think he's pretty great. No, Chris has got all the details. We'll make sure that you've got all the, you mentioned June 8th, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
June 8th for the ladder coming up here. Writers and Books Online for more information there. And at one point, I saw Alex kind of smiling when she mentioned the challenge of getting published harder than ever these days. You had this sort of a wry smile on your face. Why is that?
I don't know, maybe because it's true.
What are you hoping that writers can get out of this kind of these kind of conversations and this kind of an event with the ladder?
Well, it's sort of how, you know, I started my writing career, or my publishing career was at the time it wasn't here in Rochester. I just moved here a couple of years ago, but I'm really excited to be here, really loving it. But the way I got into got published was through similar sort of conferences and networking with individuals and meeting agents and writing instructors, and that networking, that one introduction leads to another, and suddenly I'm published.
And so did you go into this kind of process? Because a lot of writers go into this with different goals. Some would like to write for a living. Some would like to do nothing but write and get published and, you know, sell as many possible piles of thousands of copies as possible. Others say, I just want to see something in print here. I want to hold a tangible object. I'd love to get to that point. How would you describe your early goals, and how do you describe them now?
Well, for me, it was even less than that. I just wanted to finish something. I mean, we hear a lot about writing blocks,
and
one of my big blocks was just finishing something. And so what happened with me was I connected with a couple of creative friends. One was a songwriter, one was a papier-mâché artist. We encouraged each other along. They recommended me to start taking writing workshops. And so my goal was just to finish a novel. And 1 year, I figured, how long could it take? I gave it a year, and then one turned into two, three, four, five. Finally, my creative buddy said, we think you're done. And so then I called up my writing instructor, who had encouraged me to keep going. And I said, well, my friends tell me I'm done. So she's like, okay, well, let me recommend you to my agent. And it went from there. I got a letter back from the agent's assistant saying we loved it, but we'd like to see some changes. And I'm like, no way. I've worked on this for 5 years.
It's my baby. You can't change. Exactly. How dare you?
Exactly. But my friends were like, well, this is an agent. They're willing to take another look at it. And so I made the changes, and then the agent took it on. It took about a year to shop it around. And then that's how my first novel got published.
That's interesting. A good friend of mine is a Rochesterian who moved to California, has published a number of books, and has done very well for herself. And I think is a fabulous writer, but has had a couple of different agents now, which is certainly a luxury. It's hard enough to get an agent. But they have very different views on what they wanted her work to look like. And so you had this interesting place, Alex, of saying, well, I got an agent now, which is great. A lot of people want an agent, but they're making these recommendations, and I don't know if I want to do that. How did you wrestle with that?
Well, again, it was really with the help of friends that, you know, I realized that my judgment isn't always the best, and that I need trusted people around me who can really help guide me in decisions. And my agent now certainly is in that role, and I found the same with editors. Lots of times, you know, I have that initial resistance to ideas, but that usually, you know, after some distance, it's like, yeah, you know, they were right. And so it's really been part of my process to learn, just accept that I don't always have the the best judgment
or the humility.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. But you do feel that it was a good process, a good set of decisions then for the work?
Oh, absolutely. It's been about 20 years now that I've worked with the same agent, and I've really come to trust her judgment. And, you know, looking back at the books that I've had published, and I can look back and see at recommendations that editors mm-hmm. made. And all the books, they're a lot better thanks to those people.
Do you write, especially when you're working on a novel, are you trying to make a point to society, trying to tell a story that's in your head, something else? I mean, again, every writer's got a different purpose. Are you trying to make a point or to tell a meaningful sort of set of stories to make people think about something in society?
Well, for me, writing fiction, it's not so much what's the story in my head, but what's really the story in my heart. That as fiction, we're reading for emotion, and that's always the challenge, to get that emotion on the page. And again, that's where, you know, a good editor will say, here, dig deeper here, really get down to what are the feelings there. And a lot of it is, you know, my novels aren't necessarily autobiographical, but really calling upon my experiences. That's what I have most to draw on.
Give our listeners who don't know your work an example of maybe one of your most recent, the kind of story that you're trying to tell.
Well, it's funny. It's like, as I look back, you know, some writers, people say they always keep telling the same story. And my story is always be true to who you are. And that comes from my background. I'm originally an immigrant from Mexico, and felt a lot of shame about that growing up, a lot of mixed feelings about that. And so a lot of it has been, you know, about accepting myself, you know, as different. And along the way, also a lot has been, you know, dealing with my sexuality, coming to terms with my sexuality as a bisexual gay man. And you know, again, being true to that, and who am I? And, you know, fortunately for me, it's like those are topics that a lot of people in our society are grappling with now, in terms of our identities, both as sexual beings and as people of different ethnicities and races and cultures. And so it's like I keep drawing upon those stories. And again, what are the emotions there, and those conflicting emotions, both within ourselves and with others?
Where were you born, Alex?
Mexico City.
In Mexico City.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So when you talk about shame that you felt maybe earlier in your life as an immigrant from Mexico, that has to come, that wouldn't come naturally. Society has to be telling you something, whether it's people around you in schools or in workplaces or something. What was the source of that? What was driving that feeling for you?
Yeah, a lot of that was, you know, especially being so young at the time. I was 5 years old when we moved. And, you know, on the one hand, wanting to belong, wanting to be accepted, wanting to fit in, at the same time being treated as different, and eventually seeing myself as different. And so how to reconcile that yes, we're all different, but, you know, that old cliche, we're all different, but we're all the same. So learning what is my place and how to interact with other people, and what are my internal conflicts, and what are things that are, you know, being projected onto me by other people.
How much of your work, if it's not autobiographical, is at least grounded in your personal experience? And the reason I ask this is because, especially in the young adult section of literature, there are a lot of debates about who is sort of qualified to tell what kinds of stories. And there are some tough moments. There have been books scheduled for publication that have been pulled after a backlash. And how do you feel about the kinds of stories and the kinds of personal experience that you want to be able to tell when you're writing novels, again, when you're writing fiction, but how much do you feel safe telling or qualified to tell versus maybe something that's outside of your experience?
Right. Well, I mean, you're pointing out an issue that is really very recent. You know, I think historically, writers, it's all about, well, that's our job, is to be able to step into someone else's shoes. And how do they feel? So it's a challenge now, you know, in our current culture. But my always thing is, you know, well, how well can I step into that character's shoes, regardless of, you know, whether they're male, female, what race, what ethnicity, what age, whatever. You know, that's my job as a writer, to step into those shoes as authentically as I can.
Alex is going to be part of the upcoming Ladder Literary Conference, June 8th. We are certain on the date there, Red Writers and Books. If you're just joining us, we've been talking to Allison Myers, the new executive director of Writers and Books. Katyra Poland is also a local writer and a panelist at the Ladder Literary Conference. What were your early goals as a writer?
Yes, so I started writing poetry when I was in middle school. I just really enjoyed writing and reading. It was always really important to me. I was always racing to participate in the summer reading challenge and read as many books as possible. So I've just always enjoyed that. I am an editor, so I get to work with other authors and encourage them to share their stories, give them feedback, encourage them, of course, and just make their stories better. My book is actually Professionalism. And What's That? And it's nonfiction. So it focuses on conflict management, how to dress for success, text etiquette, phone etiquette, email etiquette, all the important things we need to know, but they don't teach us in school. So that's the reason that I wrote my book. But I do get to help other authors. I've helped edit like fiction and nonfiction, some autobiographies, different pieces I've been able to help with. So I've just always had a love for literacy, and that's how I got started with that.
In a moment, we'll bring in Mary Jacob. Let me just follow up and ask Katyra, when you do your editing, you know, Alex described the process of, especially in those early days, of saying, am I willing to part with some of this? Am I willing to kind of undergo that editing process when I feel so personal and connected to this? When you're working with writers and they're expressing those same things to you, how do you navigate that with them?
For sure. Just meeting with them, I'm sitting down explaining to them why I'm making those changes or why I'm suggesting those changes. It's definitely something that I encounter with all the authors, new or seasoned. They're always very anxious to have changes made to their babies, basically. And that's, you know, that's to be expected. But I just sit down with them and give them an explanation and let them know at the end of the day, this is your book. So these are things that I'm recommending as the expert. But this is your book, and if you don't, you know, want to take my suggestions, you don't have to. But just assuring them that, you know, you still have the control, but I'm here to help you to make it better.
The best editors I know are so good at, I think a lot of writers think they're going to come in and they're just going to slash and burn. They're so good at figuring out what's not needed, but also sort of how to tweak and hone and draw out a message in a story. What makes a good editor? What do you think?
Right. Yeah, I believe it's patience. Again, there's a lot of back and forth. Once you get the feedback from the author, they might decide that, you know, they're unsure about a change. But I would say patience. Also understanding. I think the fact that I'm an author, I have that I'm able to relate to them, because when I sent my book to an editor, I felt the same way. So I think I'm just having that experience with writing, a love for writing, and then also a love for reading and encouraging people, because, you know, writing is not always easy, especially if you're sharing it with the public, especially if it's something personal to you. So I would definitely say patience, understanding, relatability, and just being able to encourage other people.
Talking about the upcoming Ladder Literary Conference in Rochester, Writers and Books putting on, and it's going to be held at the Rochester Riverside Hotel on Saturday, June 8th, and you can still jump online and register and get involved. And one of the featured guests is going to be Mira Jacob. I want to ask Allison Myers to tell us a little bit about why you wanted to pick up Good Talk and what you thought of it, and we're going to bring Mira in on the phone. What did you make of this piece of work right here that's in front of you?
It's absolutely a book I would read and choose to read for my own personal enlightenment, edification, pleasure. And I think she does what every good memoirist does, which is there is a personal story, as we've been talking about, but the ways in which that story intersects with common concerns. So, for instance, her story as a girl growing up, kind of double consciousness, mirrors the experience of my own niece who wrote a zine about growing up as a biracial girl and the kinds of ways in which she was perceived, and then the entire family experience. I think there's so much in this book that's relatable, just in terms of a life trajectory. But beyond that, there's a way in which she engages with cultural conversations that are going on now in a very non-threatening way, because they are personal. They're done through the lens of different family members, her own childhood, her adulthood. And Alex used the word authentic. And I think that that's what comes through loud and clear, is the authenticity of voice. And it's also just beautifully written. And she illustrated it herself. And it's charming in that way as well. It's an incredible page turner, by the way. It looks thick, but one would read it in, one or two days.
Well, Mira's on the line with us now. And Mira, we're gratified to have the time. Thank you for taking the time. How are you?
Oh, good. Thank you for having me. And that's so lovely to hear someone talking about your book. Wow.
Allison in her first visit was excited to talk about it, and I know they're thrilled you're going to be coming to here to Rochester. And Good Talk, A Memoir in Conversations, has only been out for, I think, a couple of months now. Is that right?
Yeah, it came out in late March, exactly.
I mean, the reviews are outstanding on this, and before we kind of get into some of what your readers are sort of feeling, I want you to tell us what you set out to do when you put Good Talk together.
Absolutely. So one of the things that was happening in my life, so I have a 6-year, at the time, my son was 6. He was obsessed with Michael Jackson, which I know means a different thing now. But at the time, he was a brown boy whose color landed somewhere between me, his brown mother, and his white Jewish fathers. And he was obsessed with Michael Jackson, and he was asking all sorts of funny questions. And some of them were hilarious, like what happened to his other glove? And some of them were really hard to answer, like, is he brown or is he white? And, you know, that depends on, I said to him, well, he's black, but he sort of looks brown, and he turned white. And he said, he turned white? And I said, yes. And he said, are you going to turn white? And I said, no. And he said, am I? And I was like, no. And he said, daddy? And I said, daddy's already white. And he said, but was he always? So I had this problem, which is that I had this kid asking these really funny questions, and then some of them were really getting harder to answer, like, does Michael Jackson, what does he like being better? Does he like being brown or white better? And then one day he asked me, there's a kid named Ferguson who got shot by a white policeman because he was brown. And I said, whew, well, his name was Michael Brown, and he was shot in a town called Ferguson by a white policeman. And so what this means is all of this was coming to a head, and I knew I had to write something about it, but I couldn't write it in an essay form because I just felt like no one would believe me. So I sat down and drew it instead. And that's what this book is. It's a series of questions that he was asking me that I then started asking myself and led me to think about my life in this way. And it was all those conversations that sort of rumble around in your head and tell you who they are, who you are, but you don't ever kind of come to grips with them until something like a national crisis happens, and then you're forced to.
And so, Mira, I'm going to quote from the New York Times, if I could, taking a look at your book, and I want to talk about the way we talk to our kids and the conversations we choose to have and not have, and then who gets to choose to have these or not. Because, as a white guy with a white son who's 7, we could probably get through a lot of life without talking a whole lot about things like race and identity because of what is sort of centered and for lack of a better term, sort of typified or in our society, whereas others don't always have that choice. And here's what the New York Times writes. Quote, over the years, though, Mira finds plenty of people who do just that, who tell you that you're not American. And in the wake of 9/11, the horror binds people in the city together. But then there are others, like a man at a bar Mira goes to, who suddenly feels emboldened to make comments like, "How do we know you aren't plotting to kill everyone in here if you won't even talk to us?" I guess America kind of got weird for us for a while, Mira tells her son, while withholding all the micro and macro aggressions she's endured on the subway, in a diner, on the street, end quote. So that word withhold is interesting. You're trying to talk to a child about what America is becoming or what these moments mean when somebody might say to you in the bar, "How do we know you're not planning to kill us?" While also saying, "Am I going to say everything about what someone said on the subway?" How do you choose what to talk about and what not to talk about?
Such a good question. And I will tell you, nobody wants to be having these conversations with their kids. We would much rather be talking about, you know, Little League or whatever it is, that, you know, something light, something that seems like it's appropriate for a seven-year-old. But you can't do that when the television set is bringing in the news and he turns to you and says things like, "Does the president not like brown boys like me?" And you have to kind of answer that in a way that doesn't lie to him and also doesn't scare him too much. What I personally try to do is just answer the question I've been asked and not kind of further ahead all the reams of kind of sad knowledge I've accumulated about where that question comes from and why and what it could mean. Because I found that those things that I think are preparing him, it's not really great preparation. When those hard moments happen, they happen. There's no amount of me trying to bolster him for what it feels like to be rejected by a white friend or parent or teacher or lover. There's nothing I can say that's going to make sense of that for him. But I can kind of tiptoe cautiously toward it with him, where I answer the part that he asks, and then I always reflect back on what it meant for me. And I'm just open to the conversation. Whatever he asks is kind of what I go with.
Mira, right now, whether it is in the political world or in pop culture, just about everywhere, there are debates about identity, and there are some who push back and say we are focusing too much on identity. Generally speaking, what's your response to those who would argue that we are too focused on identity in this country?
I think that's usually an assertion made by somebody who has never had to deal with identity, so it's intensely uncomfortable for them. And they feel called out, and they feel divided, and they feel upset, and they feel like, can't we all just get along? And what usually those people don't realize is that there is an enormous amount of us that have been under that pressure for our entire lives and are now suffering under that system and are saying, this is what the pain looks like. This is what it feels like. So I understand how intolerable that pain is because I live with it every day. And I live with that level of insecurity. But when you don't look at it, and when you say, can't we just, what you're saying is, can you just be the only person that holds on to that? Can I just never be the person that holds on to that? And I would just like to say, no. No, not if you want to have the country that you think you have. Not if you want to take pride in having diversity and in having millions of different people from different places come here and feel safe. No, you don't get to retreat from this conversation right now, not if you care about us.
Just a couple of months after publication, are you hearing from readers already who either feel solidarity, maybe as parents, maybe just as people who have had to either endure those tough moments or debate on what they can talk about? Yeah, what's the kind of feedback you're getting?
It is intense right now. I'll tell you that. It is intense. I get about 5 to 10 letters a day right now. One of the things that evolves in the book is that my in-laws become very avid Trump supporters. I've been in this family for 20 years. I love them very much, and they love me very much. And it has really been painful, extraordinarily painful. And there are a lot of people that are living through that moment. So it's not just about being mixed race or diverse. It's just about a lot of us living in a different, you know, in a world where we don't know how to talk to the people we love the most about the things we care about the most. So, yeah, I get a lot of letters right now from people that say, oh, my God, I'm in it. I'm having this happen, too. You're the first person that seems to have it the same way I do. And it's been really heartening because then I can turn around and say, actually, guys, there's a lot of us here. There's a lot of us here.
Now, I want to ask the next question sort of carefully, because I don't want to sort of frame this as, well, as a person of color, speak for all people of color and tell me X, Y, and Z. But I do want to ask you, as a white parent myself, you wrote a book called Good Talk, and you are focused right now, with the publication of this book in kind of sharing these stories, sharing your approach, and you're one person. I mean, different people have different approaches to what we say to kids, how we talk to kids. But I do think there is something very different about going through life as a parent in this country when you're white, especially if you're upper class, middle class, et cetera, when you don't have to, I guess, especially if you're living sort of in suburban America, you don't always have to talk about race. I think that is well-intentioned on the behalf of a lot of parents. I can think of a lot of parents that I knew growing up, in different circles who just, we don't talk about that. We're colorblind, and it's well-intentioned, but as a result, there's not a lot of discussion about some of the harder mm-hmm. stuff. And mm-hmm. And the advantage is, well, you don't really have to. So do you have, I don't know if preference is the right word, but, is there something that you kind of wish or hope that white parents would talk about with their kids that maybe they're not, or do you think that mm-hmm. that's a space for other people to kind of debate amongst themselves? How do you feel about that?
I do think that to an extent, I think white parents are going to have to tell other white parents how to kind of lead this charge themselves, because I'm not sure that I'm going to have something that's going to be right for their
sure.
families. But I will also say this, that idea of, we can afford not to talk to our kids. If you right now are troubled by what is going on in this country, if you are scared of the future right now, if you are uncomfortable and don't understand what's going on, I would argue it's absolutely untrue. Of course you have to talk to your kids about it. That's how we get out of this place, is by you talking to your kids about it. And I think one thing that's really helpful to me, because I think when people say colorblind, what I hear is, I don't want to have to deal with whatever. I don't want to have to probe any deeper than everyone's the same to me. And I think when people really look at themselves, and this is something I do over and over in the book, I, as a brown woman, have many times that I have mishandled people's dignity and thought things about them that were incorrect. And looking at all of that, everyone thinks you'll be so, you'll just explode with shame if you look at that. And it's actually not that bad. When you look at it and you parse through it and say, okay, here's a mistake I made, it's just not that bad. It's certainly not as bad as living through a country where everybody's at their throats all the time because everyone's so scared to be ashamed. It's so much easier to just look at the thing that is scaring you.
Mira Jacob has been in Rochester as a guest of Writers and Books previously as part of the debut novel series for the debut book, The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, and now coming as part of the Ladder Literary Conference on June 8th. Part of the goal of the Ladder is helping writers, aspiring writers, Mira, figure out that process of write, edit, and then eventually end up in a published stage. And everybody wants to know, how do I get published? It's never so easy, but can you give us a little bit of a flavor of what you want to bring to writers when you come here to Rochester?
Absolutely. So I will tell you, I didn't get published until I was in my 40s, and I had been trying for years. So the thing that I would most like to tell writers is that time that you show up to write, those moments that you sit down to do the work and nobody's watching and you think, well, what am I doing? And it's you against your story or you against your essay or you even the paragraph. All of those times you show up to do that, you are in fact becoming the writer you want to be. And if I wouldn't have done that, I never would have gotten a book done. I wrote my book from 11 o'clock at night till 1 a.m. I had a corporate job. I had a child. I had a million bills to pay. And that's when I wrote it. And it changed my life getting it done. So that's the message that I would want to give to writers is keep going. People can't often see what it looks like to succeed. And these moments that you think are dark and hopeless and there's no light in sight, you're actually probably just doing the thing that needs to get done. And you should feel some pride in that.
Before I let you go, one more question for you on the power of literature, but also maybe the challenge, especially in a polarized time. And I know everybody is thinking, well, life's always polarized. It does feel a little bit more on edge these days.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's kind of two things that happen when there is literature that has, especially sort of either a political or a social point of view. There is a galvanizing effort towards maybe like-minded people when you say things like, hey, if you're concerned about what's happening in this country, you have to have these conversations. You can't avoid it. So that's one thing, to kind of galvanize people who might share a mindset. It's another to create something that breaks through to somebody who might, maybe through good intention, but have a very different life experience or think something very differently about the world, something very different about race, about experience in our society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm very curious to know if you think, whether it's Good Talk or other works that are out there in the world right now, if we're at a time where breaking through to people with different points of view is harder. Do you want people with very different points of view to kind of pick this up? And do you expect to hear more from like-minded people?
I've been surprised by how many different kinds of people have picked up this book. So that's been really just interesting to me on the whole. But I would say in general, the function of literature, right, is this, there's this incredible thing that happens, which is that you care about a life that you have no direct link to. This is a character. This is a person. This is somebody whose movements have no effect on your own. And yet somehow your heart learns to care about them in a specific way. And I think every time we do that, every time we entertain that act of imagination and compassion, we're building a bridge forward to the kind of place we actually want to be in. And that to me is essential. So yes, whether it's my book or someone else's, just going into a story that you haven't seen before and just being curious, like really being curious, is an incredible way to kind of move through the fear.
By the way, are you more or less concerned for kids who maybe had the same kinds of questions that you heard? What do you think about young children, particularly children of color right now, who are asking those questions? Are you concerned about their future in this country?
Very much so. I think the thing that people don't realize is how devastating what is happening, how much they feel that their own government does not want them here, and how many times those messages are reinforced. And I grew up with some strangeness, but I didn't grow up with that. Hmm. And that is really harrowing. And as many ways as we can get in between those kids and that message is as many times as we need to do it.
Her new book is Good Talk. Mira Jacob is coming to Rochester for the Ladder Literary Conference and Writers and Books putting that conference together. They've been thrilled to have her before, and I know they'll be thrilled to have you again. Mira, you're generous with your time. Thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to seeing you all.
All right, that is Mira Jacob joining us. We are late for our only break. When we come back, we're going to tell you a lot more about this conference coming up here on June 8th, and we'll get our guests in studio, their thoughts on what they heard from Mira Jacob next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, we welcome Rob Boston, a senior advisor to Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. We'll talk about the state of church and state in this country. Then in our second hour, Lloyd Glick joins us, the father of Jeremy Glick, one of the heroes who died on 9/11 on Flight 93. We'll talk about his legacy. Talk with you Monday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get a little listener feedback as well before I turn back to the panel. Sam in Rochester wants to weigh in on some of what he just heard. Go ahead, Sam.
Yes, thank you for having me on. I wanted to say to the lady that you just hung up on, I think she gave her son some bad advice. And I think if she goes to her conference here and gives that same advice, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be hurt and who are going to be disappointed.
All right. So why though, Sam? What's going through your mind on that?
I'm going to tell you, because you said it. You said you was talking about, I don't see color. That's one of the worst things you could say to an African-American, I don't see color. That means if you don't see color, you don't see them. And the next thing you said, you can say, well, I have some blacks for a friend. That's one of the worst things that you, now you're making excuses rather than facing the fact. And when he asked other question about Michael Jackson, she should have just told him the truth. Michael Jackson didn't like being black. He would rather be white because he thinks he can get ahead. And
I'm not sure, Sam, I'm not sure that's accurate.
Yes, it is accurate. Now you want to tell me about African Americans.
No, I'm not trying to speak for African Americans. I'm talking about Michael Jackson.
You don't know that much about African Americans. Do you know how much African Americans spend in cream trying to be white, trying to lighten themselves up? Did you hear what the girl said that won the award that was from Africa? She went to bed and prayed that she would wake up white.
Sam,
I'm not denying that.
Not for a second am I denying that. I'm simply I don't know if Michael Jackson's case was vitiligo or if it was what you're describing.
No, there wasn't nothing wrong with his skin. There wasn't a thing wrong with his skin. He didn't like being black. He'd rather be white because he thought he would get ahead faster. And you have some black people who act like that. And that's why she has to tell her son the truth. And her son, she should have told her son the truth. He's going to have some problem when he continues to grow in society. She could have told him, you got 99.9% of being killed by a police officer for just being brown, for them mistaking you to be black.
All right, so
she didn't tell them that. You have to take these opportunities to tell kids the truth. The black community do it all the time.
All right, so I got to jump in, Sam, because I think you may be misrepresenting Mira a little. I certainly didn't take the point that Mira was to not tell children, particularly children of color, the truth. And I just want to make very clear, Sam, when I brought up the point about, you know, sort of white suburban parents sometimes say, well, you know, we don't see color. My point to that was, as well-intentioned as it may be, it can be very harmful. And the idea was to at least spark a new kind of conversation that goes much beyond that surface level. But I certainly didn't hear the idea that Mira doesn't want her children or any other children to know the truth. I mean, Allison, that's not the message I got from Mira. And I respect what Sam's saying, but that's just not what I heard from
Mira. I'm just turning to the last pages of of the book.
Yeah.
Mira writes a concluding letter to her son. She said, here is the thing, though, the real true thing I still have trouble admitting. I can't protect you from everything. I can't protect you from becoming a brown man in America. I can't protect you from spending a lifetime caught between the beautiful dream of a diverse nation and the complicated reality of one. I can't even protect you from the simple fact that sometimes the people who love us will choose a world that doesn't.
That's pretty direct. Let me ask our guests for some thoughts on what they heard. Katira Poland, you know, Mira is talking about the difficult conversations that we have with children. And, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons this book is resonating the way it is. This is probably a great example of how excellent writing, creative writing, can reach people even among difficult subjects. What do you think?
For sure, I definitely agree. I appreciate her sharing her story, and I think it is important that she's honest, but she also mentioned having a delicate balance between honesty and also delivering information that a child can digest. So I definitely agree that, you know, we can use our words to empower each other, teach each other. And I do also agree that, you know, when people say I don't see color, it's very disheartening, discouraging. Also, I'm disrespectful, to be honest, because it's just saying that you don't see the person. So I do definitely agree with Mira, and I'm appreciative of the conversation of biracial people. I'm not biracial, but I always love to hear their stories. I know it's something that is growing in popularity and that a lot of people are coming across, or that it's becoming more common. So I definitely feel like it's a conversation we need to have.
Okay. Alex, what do you make of what you heard there?
Well, you know, I draw upon my own experience. You know, as I mentioned, you know, coming to the U.S. at an early age and feeling shamed about being Mexican, and then feeling shamed later on about feeling shamed. And all these layers of shame, you know, both on an individual level and in our society, you know, finding that I could pass as white and not having to tell anyone I was a Mexican. And then the same thing in terms of sexuality, that I could pass as straight, and then feeling shamed about, well, why am I trying to pass as straight? And at the same time, well, the realities of homophobia in our society. So all these complexities of identities that I think that's a lot of, you know, in our society, what we're teasing out, that, you know, things really are complex and complicated. But at the same time, that there's a lot of fun and excitement and joy in those differences.
Have you found that people who assumed you were white, when they find out that you're Mexican, that their views or their treatment of you changed?
Well, one of the amusing comments is like, well, you don't look Mexican, which is sort of like, well, what's that about? What's that stereotype that we have? Again, you know, on the one hand, you know, trying to put people into boxes. Well, one of the things that I also wanted to mention, though, that it is an exciting time in which we do have young people, you know, for example, Mira, as she mentioned, her son, but, you know, writing to younger audiences myself, you know, and visiting schools, hearing their experiences, that they're growing up with all of this complexity. And I think one of the good things about this culture moment that we're living in is that there is so much discussion, there is so much conversation, that we finally are having these conversations of seeing, you know, accepting how we are different, and at the same time, again, seeing those universalities, those commonalities among each other. Both in areas around ethnicity and race, and then also in terms of sexuality. You know, so many young people who are so much more comfortable, you know, talking about and exploring these issues, and parents who are supportive of them, exploring in schools and communities that are more supportive.
Let me ask all three of you a little bit about your thoughts on Mira's comments on the way literature might even be able to break through to people with different mindsets. She said in just a couple of months since publication of her book, she is hearing from people from a lot of different perspectives on this, which I'm sure is heartening for a writer. But that's a very difficult sort of trick to pull in this society where we're so polarized. I mean, Katira, do you view literature as having a chance to open doors, or is it more about sort of reaching people who already believe one thing or another?
I definitely think both. So being able to open doors, educate, connect, and also reach different, different groups of people. One of the things that's really important to me is considering literacy in the United States directly related to Black people, and the fact that, you know, Black people were not allowed to read or prohibited from reading. I think it's really important to focus on that, and I think it's an important topic. And just relating to opening doors, obviously reading and writing, you know, invites you to learn more about those who are around you, different cultures. You tend to learn a lot and you can connect to different people. It allows you to basically connect and that you're not shut out. So I definitely think it's important that we all have that opportunity to do that and connect with other people and not, discriminate. Or I think without the reading piece in the literature, it creates more conflict than solutions. So,
okay. Alex, can you reach people across sort of different boundaries through literature?
Well, in YA literature, we talk a lot about books as both mirrors and windows, that it can be so important for a young person, now that we are seeing more and more diverse literature, for a young person for the first time to say, wow, there's someone else like me and I can read their stories. And so oftentimes in YA literature or young people's literature in general, they can be very challenging stories, but also ultimately very positive and affirming stories, so that young people can have that mirror of an affirming portrait of someone like themselves, and that these books can also be windows. So for people who aren't of the same in whatever particular aspect, they get in a window into what it's like to be in that person's shoes and that person's point of view.
Okay, Allison?
I think it's especially critical that a multiplicity of stories are being published for the young adult audience and children's books as well. I just attended Color of Children's Literature Conference put on by Quailee Journal in New York City, and the iconic children's author Jacqueline Woodson said, children's literature is a space where the revolution can happen. Mm-hmm. She meant revolution of consciousness and expansion of, where openness, ideas, and acceptance and accountability can be generated. So I'm especially thankful that more and more writers are engaging with those audiences. But Mira's book, for instance, I think one of the reasons why it's a successful communicator across all kinds of readers and audiences is the fact that she never gets on a soapbox and preaches. In fact, the book is filled with more questions than it is absolute answers. And that was reflected in her philosophy when she talked about what in what ways can we navigate the world and make sense of its complexities and contradictions and become better people? And she said, ask a lot of questions. And it's a very non-threatening way, I feel. At least I experienced the book that way. And I think through fiction in particular, as well as poetry and creative nonfiction, these are the ways in which our imaginations can be, we transport ourselves into other places, other people's experiences. I think it's the virtually the most generative place for consciousness raising that we have as an art form.
All right. We've had a fascinating conversation this hour and a lot coming your way from Writers and Books, WAB.org. If you want to check out the latter literary event that's coming up on June 8th, you can still register and they'd love to have you there. And our guests are going to be there. Katira Poland and Alex Sanchez are going to be there as panelists for the latter literary conference. And Allison Myers, who's been in Rochester for all of a week, is certainly going to be there. The new executive director of Writers and Books. Welcome. Let's have more conversations. Can we
Thank
do that?
Thank you. I would love it. Thanks so much for hosting this. It's been a great conversation to be part of.
Well, you're going to see here in Rochester, the NPR member stations are very keen on what's going on in the art community and the literary community. And I think we're going to have a lot more to say. WAB.org for more information there. Thank you, Allison, Alex, Katira. Great having all of you here. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Megan Mack, who is the producer and engineer all week. Wow. Awesome stuff. Dolores has done such great work for us volunteering today, and Gary Putup has been mildly tolerable behind the glass as well. Thank you, Gary. Our thanks to everyone who helped put this program together, even Chris Fanning. And thanks to you, the listener, for being with us all week long. Hope you have a beautiful weekend, and we're back with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.